On this episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, we have a special guest, and we will be talking about AMD's second generation Threadrippers. Coming up next. How you doing, everybody? Marco Cipetta with Hot Hardware here. I am with a special guest from AMD. I have James Pryor. James, why don't you introduce yourself quick? Tell everybody what you do at AMD.
Sure. Hi, Marco. Hi, everybody. I'm James Pryor. I'm a senior product manager in the client enthusiast team. Means that I work on all the cool products like Threadripper, Ryzen, how we bring them into market, what we define them as, and then, you know, how we make sure they're the best products possible for you guys out there.
Cool. And before you started doing this, you were kind of an enthusiast way before you ever connected with AMD, right? What's sort of your background? What made you sort of fall in love with tech and get involved in this kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, a long time ago, I loved playing around with my PC, cut my teeth, you know, building old Athlon XPs, doing the pencil trick, trying to unlock them and, you know, make them into dual socket processors, that kind of stuff, just having a fun time with gaming. So I went into a career in IT, was a sysadmin for a while, building out smart grid infrastructure, that kind of stuff. And at the same time, I was, you know, obviously trying to be a gamer and have some fun and overclocking and things like that. And that's how I got involved in a community like Hot Hardware. But I was over at Rage 3D. And that's where you and I first met, was through when being reviewers, being at the same events and stuff.
That's right. Many, many, many years ago, we are some of the OGs in online tech going on right here. So, yeah. That's so, right. James, it was integral in the launch of AMD's second generation Threadripper processors. We have a full review up at Hot Hardware. We have two models that we covered in our review, the Ryzen Threadripper 2950X and the Ryzen Threadripper 2990WX. Now, although they're both Threadrippers, these are two very different processors. James, why don't you tell everybody sort of what makes these new Threadrippers different than the first gen? And then we'll talk about sort of the new models and naming and how to differentiate these parts.
Sure. So with our second generation, we added in all the features that we developed for second gen Ryzen. So, you know, every Ryzen die is born wanting to be a Threadripper, but only 5% of them get to make it. And that 5% have all the features you saw from the 12 nanometers, such as precision boost, XFR2, that's now purely linear across all cores and threads, taking advantage of as much thermal headroom, how much power delivery headroom you've got inside the processor. So all those improvements, plus the new Zen Plus core architecture with the increased IPC, the lower latency L1, L2, L3 caches, and the lower latency to the memory controllers and the main system memory are all included inside of second generation Threadripper. And that's really what made a big difference in our ability to define the products, because at any different or given frequency, we're able to reduce the core voltage by between 80 and 120 millivolts, which, you know, is not a huge amount across a four-core processor, but across 32 cores, 120 millivolts per core, per clock speed, that's massive. And that's, and that really enabled us to get out there with this 32-core 2990WX.
So, and that's another one of the big differences with this launch. With the first Threadrippers, we had, you know, eventually when it was completely fleshed out from 8 cores on up to 16 cores. But now with this new family, what's been announced so far is 12 cores on up to that massive 32 core. Now, but at the heart of these chips is the same die, same piece of silicon, but they're sort of arranged differently on these guys, right? What's the difference between the Threadripper X series and the really high-end WX series?
Yeah, so X series are two die in a single package. So we can put up to four die down inside the processor package. It's really what enabled us to create this super scalable platform. But we use two die in the X series, so you can do a 12 or a 16 core configuration. And each die has access to memory, so a total of a quad channel configuration, 64 PCIe lanes, up to 16 cores, 32 threads, and 40 megabytes of smart prefetch cache. Then we got a WX series, we're going up to four die. And in that configuration, you've still got two die that are directly connected to memory, and the other two die are connected via the Infinity Fabric to every other die to connect to the PCIe and the memory controllers. So that gives us that massive high core count of 32 cores, 64 threads, gives us 80 megabytes of smart prefetch cache on that 32-core product. And we use the Infinity Fabric to connect all those cores and dies together. So between in each die, you've got 8 cores, which is 2 core complexes that are connected together with the Infinity Fabric. And then each die talks to every other die with an independent 50 gigabyte per second link. So you can get massive amounts of data flowing through this chip, 150 gigabytes per second on aggregate for one die talking to the other 3 die at the same time. So lots of data are able to be moved around inside the chip, and all of that's accessed at the same time across the fabric. So that's really the big difference between a 2 die, which is 16 cores, and the 32 core with 4 die.
And now this is AMD's first 32 core desktop processor or something sort of targeting end users, but AMD also has 32 core EPYC processors. Now, the ones that are out in market now are using the first gen sort of Zen core. But if somebody were to say, these new Threadrippers, they're just EPYCs with, you know, 2 memory channels shut off. Is that correct? What sort of differentiates AMD's 32 core EPYC from these new Threadrippers?
Well, there's a ton of product details and market differentiation. So EPYC has 8 channels of memory, where we've got 4 channels of memory in the Threadripper. And even though they share the same physical socket, the pins are used very, very differently. So they're not socket compatible. You can't put an EPYC into a Threadripper and it boot up. You can't put a Threadripper into an EPYC and it boot up. The pins are mapped differently. The die is mapped differently. And they're using different die from our production line. Like I said, EPYC are using the original Zen core it's built on 14 nanometer, but we've moved to a 12 nanometer product and a Zen Plus core with Threadripper. So different production lines, different dies, different internal configuration on the substrate, different configuration in the package, different use of pins. EPYC has all of the enterprise reliability and security features you want from an enterprise product. And it's tuned for throughput. So, you know, all those cores and threads has more cache available for same level of cache, but more PCIe lanes for connecting to external devices, 128, plus the has RAS, remote administration, as well as LRDIMM support. Whereas if you go look at Threadripper, we don't have those features. We don't have ECC beyond normal UDIMM ECC. That's a big differentiator right there. And our boost clocks are much, much different. So our TDPs are much higher. We're using 250 watt TDP on our 32 core, much higher than the EPYC 32 core. And that lets us do fun things like precision boost and XFR2, and also the fun things like precision boost overdrive. That's something that's not available on EPYC, but is available on the Ryzen Threadripper.
Yeah, very cool. When we get to, I want to talk about Ryzen Master later and PBO, because I thought that was actually one of the really cool things with this launch. When our article went up, we had a couple of comments or, you know, some sentiment was sort of like, you know, the 2950X, the X series is really where gamers should be looking, and the WX series with all those cores and because of that special memory configuration, those are really just for workstation users that, you know you're going to be whacking all those cores with huge workloads and you need that kind of compute performance. Do you agree with that? Is there some sort of gray area there with these chips?
Not a lot of gray area. That's a very good way of looking at it. I think if you're a pure gamer, if all you're interested in is gaming performance, then probably our Ryzen 7 and Ryzen 5 processor lineup is the most attractive to you. If you do anything other than gaming with your PC, like you want to be a streamer, you want to work on video editing, you want to work on content creation, you use Blender more than just to run the Ryzen graphic test, right? Then you're going to like Threadripper because it gives you so much scalability and headroom. And, you know, Threadripper as a brand appeals to everybody. It's an enthusiast brand. It's in your face. It's awesome. It's everything everybody wants. It's a long-term, highly scalable platform. You know, if you buy into this in 5 years' time, your PC is still going to have horsepower to spare, and you've now got 2 generations of products to think from, and you've got tons of I/O with PCIe. So I can definitely see why gamers who do a little bit of streaming, who do video encoding, who do, you know, editing and videos, who like to mess around with 3D modeling, those guys would want to buy into a Threadripper platform. Now, we called the 32-core and 24-core parts WX for a very specific reason. The price point and the applications that scale out to those kind of levels of cores and threads are very securely and firmly in the workstation market, right? If you're looking at people who can use 32 cores, they don't tend to look at single application scaling. They're not looking for like, oh, hey, my handbrake encode now goes 50% faster because my 1080p to 720p transcode is accelerated, because they understand Amdahl's law and how it's harder to break up a workload into small segments if it's a tiny workload. They're looking at 4K and 8K video and applying multiple layers of features, video stabilizations, and processing that in the background while they're working on another project. So they're very much in the mood of, they are creators who do multitasking, where they're multitasking while Handbrake is going on. They're multitasking while Blender is rendering. They're multitasking while DaVinci Resolve is exporting a video or working through a color correction cycle. They're always doing something more. And for those guys, it's all about time to completion and the amount of throughput through the machine for their workflow. So definitely a lot of truth to WXs for professionals and workstation users. We called it WX to line up with Radeon Pro WX, because we have a presence in that space already. But if you're an enthusiast out there looking at 32 cores and thinking, you know what, I bet that'll run Fortnite smoothly, go look at Ryzen 7. That's a better product for you. But if you're thinking that, you know, you want to run lots of VMs, if you're into high resolution rendering, if you're thinking that subsurface scattering of light rays on a complex surface is something you want to model, then 32 core WX is your guy.
Yeah, you know, looking through the numbers after I had a chance to play with the chip, you see those scenarios where if you do leverage all those cores, you know, it can be up to 50% and sometimes more than that faster than your competitor's fastest desktop chip. So yeah, but where they're not getting hit super hard and maybe there's some sort of penalty because of the memory configuration, it's not quite as fast, and you know, the X series or even a Ryzen 7 might be a better choice. But, you know, these chips, they're sort of configurable. So with the Ryzen Master software, you can disable cores and sort of work around that if you have the budget and you just want the most powerful machine, because maybe you sort of toy around with modeling or doing some heavy workloads, but you also want to be a gamer. You can still work around that, can't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. With Ryzen Master, you get the full configurability of an enthusiast platform like you would expect from AMD. You can go to a two-die mode. You can go to a local memory mode. You can move things around just because, you know, you need to have the ability to tune to your workload at a hardware level while we're waiting for the software to catch up. I think it's very clear that AMD is moving faster than the software ecosystem can. So while we're waiting for different aspects of the operating systems and the applications and the workloads to catch up so that everything scales out to 32 cores, then there's the opportunity for different, you know, kinds of tweaking around and tuning it up and making it the most optimal product for your exact moment in time right now. So, yeah, you can see right now the raw performance of 32 cores in a lot of applications is great. In some other applications, it's not. And that's why we enable guys like yourself to do an independent review, look at the product, see where it's got strengths today, see where there's reasons for improvement, and that way people can make an informed purchase decision. That's really what's key here, is understanding your workload and testing it out so that you know whether you're going to get the response that you expect. Because I think some people kind of looked at, you know, 32 cores and said, oh, it's going to be double what we've seen before. And, you know, for a lot of things, that's going to be true. But some things it's not, because, you know, we did have to work with the inside of a thermal constraint. We didn't double the TDP from 180 watts to 360. We went to 250. So you're not going to get purely linear scaling just because of that right off the bat. And then number two, you know, Zen architecture has only been in market less than 18 months. and that's inside of the software development cycles of most major application developers. That's, you know, they're still getting a chance to get hands-on and really understand Zen Core as a brand new x86 architecture, our memory layout and configurations, what's, you know, they need to do to tune and be specifically optimized for us. And that just takes a little bit of time to flow through. So today is raw performance, all horsepower. As we go on down the line, you're going to see more and more improvements and updates. They're going to benefit everybody.
It's funny that you mentioned, you know, AMD maybe is a little ahead of the curve with the 32 cores. On a previous podcast, someone had asked, you know, why didn't they come out with a 32 core on the previous gen? And I had said, you know, the 16 core really, really pushed the envelope at the time. I think, and the market sort of had to get used to that. Software had to react. Consumers had to realize the benefits. I think if AMD did a 32 core on the first gen, people would have went, they're nuts. They're crazy. Nobody's going to use that. But the 16 core sort of laid the foundation. And now everybody was ready this time around for a 32 core. Do you sort of agree with that?
Totally, 100%. When we launched 16, a lot of feedback of, wait, so how am I supposed to use 16? This is too much. But within 6 months, we had a lot of very direct feedback saying, I love it. This is what I need. I didn't know that I needed it, but now I do, because I found ways to use all those cores and threads. Applications are scaling well. The mega tasking is beautiful. I can do things I didn't think I could do before. So that was very gratifying. You know, from a technology perspective, we needed to wait for the 12 nanometer transistor, the faster clock speed at the lower power before we could enable 32 cores. That really what gave us a compelling product definition with 32 and 24 cores. So 16 was, you know, to define the market and test it, and then 32 to expand and grow and really drive Ryzen into the highest levels of performance. So that's how we're able to have the world's fastest desktop consumer processor today.
Very cool. So actually, I had a question pop into the chat that I want to see if you have a good answer for. So Joe Nexus is asking, would VMware Workstation work well on a Threadripper WX series in a dev environment? Is that something that you can see working well there?
Yeah, most hypervisors should work well. You know, if you're spinning up multiple 4-core VMs to run your environment in your modeling, testing, that kind of stuff, you're going to have pretty good performance right there because you've got all the cores and threads, especially compared to the price per VM if you were trying to compare to a 2P server that would be equivalent cores and threads. So it's going to give you a lot of headroom. I don't see any specific reasons why you wouldn't be able to do that and have a good experience with it.
Gotcha. So moving on to sort of another aspect with these Threadrippers, it's kind of a riff off. You mentioned that you guys didn't double the TDP. You went from 180 to 250 watts. That's obviously still, you know, you need some decent cooling performance to handle a chip that has a 250 watt TDP. Now, alongside with these processors, AMD worked with Cooler Master to bring out a really kind of massive, really cool cooler. John, I don't know if you can. I dropped a link in the chat. I have pictures of this cooler in the article. It was called the Wraith Ripper. Can you tell us a little about the Wraith Ripper, how long that was sort of in development, and why you guys decided that it probably be a good idea to partner with somebody on an air cooler for that thing?
Yeah, sure. So with our first-gen Threadripper, we had, you know, 15, 17 different coolers that we enabled for the first round, right? 180 watt TDP. And, you know, in isolation, that sounds like a really high TDP, especially compared to Ryzen, which was 95 watts. But, you know, we had a little bit of experience with higher TDPs, FX9590 at 220. You know, if you look at the difference of the performance available from an FX9590 to a Threadripper, it's monstrous. Absolutely incredible efficiency gains. And, you know, that let us know how much, you know, work we need to put into the ecosystem. So we enabled that with our first gen, a ton of coolers, off the shelf, compatible, because we included an Asetek adapter bracket inside of the PIB, still do. So you can use Asetek adapted coolers, liquid coolers with Threadrippers, first and second gen. And then, you know, we had a lot of coolers being developed by other third parties, and Cooler Master, who are a close partner with AMD, approached us with a design, and they said, you know, we'd like to use this for Threadripper. Can you test and validate? Is there anything you want to see us do on this one? And what we hadn't seen at that time was, you know, this beautiful RGB and Ryzen logoed cooler in the market for Threadripper. You know, with our Ryzen series, we managed to introduce some really cool updates, especially on the Ryzen 7. The LEDs on the Wraith coolers are very well received by a lot of people. And we decided to try and enable that in the Threadripper realm as well. So about 7 or 8 months before we were planning to introduce second-gen Threadripper, we had a conversation about adapting their design, licensing the AMD Ryzen Threadripper logo, letting them use the Wraith brand name to market and everything else, because we wanted an air cooler that would stand on itself, be enabled for our new 250-watt TDP configuration, and offer a great look and appeal as well. So that's where that really came from. It was a lot of fun to work on with them. I don't know if you guys know, but I'm the product manager for the Wraith coolers within AMD, so I get to give a lot of guidance on what the coolers look like. So if you guys like or don't like Wraith coolers, then I'm the guy to tell, so you can give me your feedback on what you like and don't like.
Yeah, so the last, they've actually been, you know, in my opinion, really, you know, it, with the standard Ryzen desktop processors, to get with the models that do include those nice coolers, that's a huge add-in, because it's such a high quality cooler to be, you know, that processor in a box cooler. It's something that somebody would buy separately for, you know, 20, 30, maybe even $40. So that's a nice add-on, in my opinion. The Wraith Ripper, I also think, you know, it performed well in my testing. I did all my formal testing on a liquid cooler, because that's what I did for the originals, and I needed to keep sort of the baseline the same. But I was really impressed, you know, the design with that fan in the middle and the way the fin stack sort of protects it and sort of muffles it, to get that kind of cooling performance. I mean, it is massive. It's heavy as a bunch of heat pipes, sure. But the way the socket's designed, you know, for Threadripper, it's not a problem supporting it. And it's a really cool setup with that logo. So I personally like the Wraith Ripper. I haven't gotten any negative feedback from anybody in terms of the articles or even in chat now that you say that. So probably going to be thumbs up from everybody. But you know, while we're talking coolers, though, some of the chatter with Threadripper, and this is going all the way back to the beginning, was some of the Asetek-based coolers, you know, you don't have full contact on the integrated heat spreader. It's sort of centered on the spreader. Now, most people will say, or some people will say, hey, this is not an issue. But there's some that say you will get better cooling performance if you have a full contact, full cover cooler. Opinions there, something to sort of set the community straight on expectations?
Yeah, so, I mean, AMD's thermal engineering department validated the Asetek head that has the smaller circle that doesn't give full coverage on the heat spreader for our worst case thermal environment, which is 32C inside the case and full load on the product. So we don't see throttling using those coolers under those conditions. That's really our worst case validation right there. So it's quite a hot inside of a PC for a high-end desktop like this. Now, those coolers, that head covers the die completely. It doesn't cover the heat spreader. The heat spreader is much, much bigger than the die. And that's the whole point of the heat spreader, is to dissipate all that heat, move it out and across. So as you move to a bigger coverage block, you will get more improved thermal performance. So this is just upside. It's just better. And because of that is the reason why we have things like Precision Boost 2 and XFR 2, where if you're in a thermally advantaged situation, like you've got more cooling capacity than you're not sitting there at 32C, then you're going to see higher clocks across all cores and threads in second gen Threadripper. You know, I saw one guy in the reviews, I can't remember who it was, but he saw 3.3, 3.4 gigahertz on all 32 cores under load, 100% load, using the Wraith Ripper because he was in a 20C ambient room. Now, yeah, that's perfect, right? That shows you exactly why we built the intelligence of SenseMI, Precision Boost 2, XFR 2 into the product, because you get that kind of extra uplift in clock speed that gives you real world more performance. And, you know, if you spend more on your cooling, on your home environment, you should get more. And that's what you do with Threadripper. There's nothing left on the table for you to go find because of how it works. You just get extra performance. It goes faster.
Yeah, that's one of the details. It's tough to, you know, unless you kind of go to extremes in your lab, it's tough to show wide performance deltas, but with intelligent processors like this that will, you know, boost as long and as often as they can, power and temperature permitting, the better your temps, the better performance is. You know, assuming you have adequate power, if temps are low, you get better perf, you know, over the long haul with these chips. And, you know, that's really cool. And just quickly before we move on, we have some feedback on the coolers. The stock coolers for Ryzen are outstanding and overclock well, James. So a pat on the back from the gallery here for you.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Nice. So now one of the other things with Threadrippers and with this, the latest second gen Threadrippers, I should say. Now, AMD maintained compatibility with the existing X399 motherboards. Do you want to give some information on why AMD did that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, 12 months from first gen to second gen is quite a short time. They definitely didn't want to, when we're trying to establish this new product line, this new market segment for AMD, we didn't want to move too fast and change too much. So, you know, we had quad channel memory bandwidth, we had class leading IO with 64 PCIe lanes, we had class leading core counts for a short amount of time, helped redefine the market on what that looked like. And then when we took a look at the quality of board that was built for the first gen Threadrippers, it was very easily obvious that you're going to have plenty of headroom for the second gen. So it was very easy for us to create what we call an infrastructure group, the 250 watt class WX series, that we're going to fit inside the performance and power requirement profile that was already in market. And that's why it was very easy just to issue a BIOS update that makes compatibility simple and easy. And the best part was all these motherboards were already enabled with USB updating, so you don't need a first-gen processor to update your board. You can use no processor at all on some boards. Other boards, you need to put a processor and memory in, but you just put the file onto the USB stick, plug it in, turn on the board, and mash the button that says BIOS update, and off it goes. You're compatible. So it's the simplest and easiest ecosystem update we've ever done. It was very fun to do because it was just so simple.
Yeah, that's actually 2 points that I want to clarify there. So if you're updating a system, and let's say you bought a motherboard that has been on the shelf for a while, and a new processor comes out, and that motherboard doesn't have support for this new particular processor integrated into its BIOS, lots of times you'll get it home, plug it in, turn it on, and it just won't boot. And with some boards, you have to plug in a previous gen processor to flash the BIOS with the new BIOS before you can put in the latest processor to get it to work. But since X399 has BIOS flashback support, you can literally update the boards without using one of the previous gen processors. Now, another point which is interesting with the X399, I've only had a chance to, since the second gen Threadripper is launched, I've only had a chance to use three boards and only two of them for sort of an extended period of time. But what I noticed is, if I went into PBO, the Precision Boost Overdrive in Ryzen Master, there was a ton of power headroom left with all of the boards I checked. Did the motherboard guys build in that extra power headroom, you know, purposefully for overclockers or knowing what was going to happen in the future?
Yeah, they had an inkling of where we were going and what we wanted to do, and they knew this was going to be something special, so they definitely made sure there was a ton of headroom. We wanted to be very clear, you know, that's some of that comes from our reference guidance. We wanted to ensure there was a guard band, and some of it comes from their desire to be the board underneath the world records and stuff. So that's why you've seen these fantastic new boards like the MSI X399 MEG Creation with 19 power phases, 16 of them for the CPU. It's a monstrous amount of power. It's incredibly efficient for a stock 32 core, and it delivers amazing amounts of power for overclocking, even under liquid nitrogen. But all the boards out there have a little bit of OC headroom in them. You go into PBO and turn it on, you'll see a really nice, healthy uplift, maybe 10 to 13% in certain workloads that use all cores and threads, because it just gives you so much more power from the motherboard. That was a pretty cool thing to enable, was reading in the values that the manufacturer decided as their max for operation versus what we had defined as our max for operation. So, you know, there's PPT, which is your package power target, kind of like your TDP of your processor. You can take that from the standard 250 up to like 500 watts. So if you want to pretend your processor is a 500 watt TDP, you can just plug that into Precision Boost Overdrive in Ryzen Master and see what it does. Same goes for electrical design current and for your EDC and your PPT, EDC, and TDC, which is your thermal design current as well. So you've got the thermals for the VRMs. You've got the thermals for the socket. You know, the manufacturer definition was what they think is right as an overclocking condition to avoid things like sparking out VRMs or releasing the magic smoke from the chokes or burning a pin in the socket, that kind of stuff. But, you know, you can tweak those values if you want and see what else is left in the board at your own risk. Don't do it because I said so, but have some fun with it and see where the performance goes.
Yeah, I mean, I personally watched the MSI Meg board with the air cooler, with the Wraith Ripper, literally by just turning on PBO and maxing the values that were available, a Cinebench score approaching 6,100. And I think on some of the tests, it broke 6,100, but the one that I watched, it was over 6,000, just ticking a switch in Ryzen Master and cranking up those power targets and boom, monster Cinebench score out of a 2990 WX. Now I have another question in the chat, James, but I think I can just answer it quickly. Joe's asking, is there any scope to mandate USB flash without a CPU in the socket for the whole range, for the whole Zen range? Now, I don't think that's something the motherboard guys are going to have to tackle. I guess AMD could mandate it if they wanted to, but there's such a wide range of motherboards and price points for the different Zen processors. I don't think it's something that would happen across the board. But on any sort of enthusiast board, even some many non-Threadripper boards, you do have that BIOS flashback support, and you may not necessarily need an older processor to update. Let me see. We talked about the motherboards, X39 and cooling. So let's talk about a little bit on overclocking and Ryzen Master and how that PBO works, because that's one of the cool features with the Threadripper. So if you come by Hot Hardware, check out my review. I have a whole page where I show what the new Ryzen Master 1.4 update for second gen Threadripper looks like. And I explain, in sort of plain English, how Precision Boost Overdrive works. But there's some backstory that we should probably cover with overclocking on Threadripper and even original Ryzen processors. So on original Ryzen Threadrippers, if you were to overclock manually, you sort of set the multiplier, set your voltages, and you lose some of the advanced features in the chip, right, James? But PBO behaves differently. Why don't you give some of the nuance there and explain why overclocking manually is different from PBO?
For sure. So there's a couple of characteristics of the transistors we had to overcome. So when you look at the CPU core, for a second-gen Ryzen or a Threadripper, if you keep that core under 50C, then you can keep pushing that clock up and up and up, and it'll just keep going. 1.5 volts doesn't hurt it. It's the temperature that you need to worry about. So, if it's under 50C, it's just going to keep boosting higher and higher. Over 50C, you're going to start seeing the clocks come down a little bit as the stability moves around. So when we looked at our boost algorithm to try and get rid of that plateau where we had on first gen, where you got two threads boosting and then everything else running at the base clock, we looked at that linearity and we can really be smart here. The chip can look at hundreds of points inside of itself for workload estimation, for temperature, for current draw, for power consumption, and know how much guard band there is less, so we can keep pushing the clocks up and keep managing the voltages. But when you go to a manual overclocking mode, you turn all of that off. You walk away from the ability to still hit that boost. So it's very hard to keep a 32-core processor at a sustained clock speed, over 4 gigahertz, and keep it under 50C. So you're going to not hit quite the same amount of clock rate. So to avoid taking away that high single-thread performance, for lightly threaded apps, we baked in the intelligence of XFR and Precision Boost by moving the limiters that are our basic product definition. right? So if we said, okay, if it's not a 250-watt processor and it's not limited to, you know, so, you know, a couple of hundred amps of power, but it's, you know, it's 500 amps and it's 500 watts, what can the product do? Then you all of a sudden start to see a whole lot more clock headroom between the peak rate and the base rate. It just really moves that curve up and to the right of precision boost. And all you're doing really is just letting the processor go much, much, much further into its boost curve that it would be able to hit. So, you know, that really is going to give you much, much more balanced overclocking mode if you're not using high-end liquid nitrogen, right, and going for super cold cores. Now you can still get, like, on the 2950X, it's got a 4.4 gigahertz boost clock, the highest of any Ryzen processor. You don't want to walk away from that and go for 4 gigahertz just to get all 16 cores at 4 gig or 4.2. You want both. You want as much as you can get. And that's what PBO really lets you do. And if you think about a 16-core, you know, 180-watt TDP processor in a 250-watt platform, that's a massive amount of headroom. And then think about it in the context of, hey, that 32-core has got tons of headroom still. These motherboards are way over-designed. Man, that's a ton of headroom you've got there for PBO. So it's really just taking the limitations of temperature and current delivery and thermal capacity from the motherboard VRMs and moving those limits up to the actual design versus our worst case product definition. That's really where that PBO kicks in. So like you said, you can just turn it on at the desktop. It works right there and then. You don't have to reboot. You can turn it on in the BIOS if you want, but you can just turn it on right when you need it, and bam, there's all the extra performance you can get.
Yeah, it made, like, instead of manually overclocking, I just showed the PBO number because it just made sense. You know, like James was saying, if you're manually overclocking a many core chip, you might hit an every core frequency that's lower than the XFR max boost frequency. So you're giving up some performance for lightly threaded workloads. And that's, you know, we're enthusiasts, we're nerds, we like having those huge multi-threaded numbers, but for the vast majority of the time, many of us, that single thread performance is important, tooling around the desktop, browsing, checking email, doing work. So if you don't want to give that away, that's where sort of PBO comes in. Flip it on, you can maximize. And the other thing I should mention, at least in my experience, lots of times it's a power limitation when you're manually overclocking a Threadripper. So using PBO, it kind of balances everything out. You're going to get the max power that you set. So, you know, you're going to go to that power limit anyway without giving up that peak lightly threaded sort of, you know, XFR boost clock. So I just showed the PBO numbers because they were you know, a significant boost. And it was just so easy. It literally just flip a switch, kind of balance out your power numbers for your particular board and bang. But that brings up another point. So anybody working sort of with PBO and with their setup, the expected performance is going to vary based on the cooler, the motherboard, and maybe even the power supply to some degree, right? Based on how power is getting delivered, how much headroom is available, and temps, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about a manually set overclock and product definition, then you've dialed that in and stress tested it on one day or one specific set of configurations. And if anything changes, if you have any degradation of your power supply or a change in your workload, then you don't know whether you're still going to be able to sustain that rate or not. And PBO, what that lets you do is you never have to worry about that because it's automatically going to adjust based on the temperature, like day to night, or it's winter to summer. You know, people oftentimes overclock in the wintertime and they have to dial it back in the summertime because the whole house is hotter. You know, that's, and the AC is running, so the power is dirtier coming from the wall, and that introduces ripple into your power supply, so you're not as stable. These are all things that don't worry PBO because they're always managed and made a millisecond decision time. So you're always going to get that constant dial in, that management of the overclock on all cores and threads. Now, if you choose to dial up the PBO values beyond what the motherboard specification says, you're going to go back into that little bit of uncertainty and unknown. But hey, that's the whole point of an enthusiast platform, is to find the limits, find the edges, and have fun with it. You know, take it to the edge.
Cool. And that's just a little pie in the sky type stuff, because the groundwork sort of seems to be there for you guys. And you may not be able to comment, but I'm going to ask anyway. So if when we were talking earlier about how the 2990WX, the 32 core, the way the die and the memory are configured, and how, you know, not every workload is sort of optimized for that platform, and you can alleviate some of the issues by disabling cores, and in turn, which will change the memory configuration as well. Now, the way it stands today, when you disable cores, you have to reboot with Ryzen Master. But I'm sort of thinking about, you know, there's cars nowadays with huge, you know, 8-cylinder engines that sort of drop down to 2 cylinders when you're just tooling around to save gas, but turn on all 8 cylinders when you need them. Is there any possibility in the future, maybe working with Microsoft along with updates to Ryzen Master, where a chip like the 2990WX, when you're not taxing all the cores or you're running a workload that's maybe not optimized for the new memory configuration, where it automatically disables, but when you run an app that needs them, it'll flip them all on. Is that ever a possibility in the future?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yeah, there's some work we can do there. We can look at core parking and scheduling and kind of lassoing some processes onto certain cores and die. You know, when we call it core disabling, it's really just core scheduling. When we use Ryzen Master to go like on the 16 core down to an 8-core mode, then we're not actually turning off the die because the memory controller is still active, the PCIe, USB SATA, all the features inside the SoC are still on. The OS is just not scheduling to that die. And that's a boot time feature for that OS. And you can't turn on and off cores and threads underneath the hood for that OS. It doesn't like it. It's, you know, it's kind of like starting your PC with 2 GPUs in and then deciding halfway through, I'm just going to pull one out while we're running. You know how that's going to work out. It's not going to work well. So when you know, and on our 32 core with 4 die, it's the same thing. We don't turn off any dies. We just restrict the scheduling using boot time parameters. It's BCD edit is what we're using. It's pretty simple and easy to do. And that just helps manage different workloads until the software optimizations and other optimizations come into market. And that's definitely something we're looking at, how to manage that, how to keep that working. And so these high core count chips on the bleeding edge can be improved. There's some things we could have done differently in the product specification. Like if we were okay with breaking socket compatibility, we could have gone to quad channel memory with 1 channel per die. But then, you know, everything that was lightly threaded and still needed a little bit of bursty memory access would have suffered a performance impact. So looking at the workloads available today, it was a better decision to have, you know, 2 die with 2 channels of memory each. So they've got nice low latency access and fast memory throughput, and then have 2 die that didn't have. So when you get those big workloads that just crush through, you know, hundreds of megs and gigabytes of data, they're not so much latency sensitive as they are throughput sensitive. And we've got that massive Infinity Fabric bandwidth to support that. So, you know, any workload that's a little bit transient is what we're seeing, what some people can call a lack of scaling on from the 16 to the 32 core. It's really an artifact of not the processor design as much as it is the workload level. Some things just don't scale to 32 cores. It's kind of the same as we saw with graphics drivers when you go to a really high resolution or you go to a really low resolution. Like some of the performance scaling rolls off because you just can't feed that graphics card fast enough with all the information for it to chew through it, or you get like 50% utilization because it's done before it even got a chance to scale out across all the graphics processing cores. So that's just what you're seeing with 32 cores and why the memory configuration is a specific way. But yeah, there's things we can do in the software realm. A little bit early to talk about it yet, but you know, the feedback from the community is incredibly instructive. It's very much welcome. So you guys keep giving us what you want to see, what your thoughts are, so we can continue to address it.
Cool. And now over the lifespan of going back to the original Ryzen launch, you guys sort of optimized performance in a number of ways. You updated the AGESA code in the BIOS at the BIOS level. You optimized the power profiles in Windows. I believe you worked with Microsoft on some scheduling issues. Do you think people will continue to sort of see these incremental updates over time with the platform, or are we kind of plateaued at this point? Has Ryzen been out long enough where you're not going to see any sort of major jumps, you know, with a BIOS update or a software update?
Yeah, there's some more work to be done. There's definitely things we can go improve on our side in terms of software. I think that mostly we're going to be looking at ecosystem updates from this point forward, you know, the OS and the applications as they find ways to take advantage. A little bit of workflow from the actual end users, what they're trying to do. You know, 2 years ago, editing 1080p was everything and anything. And then it became, you know, it started to be a 4K conversation. So now as people getting more into 4K and starting to create their renders at 4K and then transcode down for final broadcast in 1080 or even just broadcast in 4K, then we're seeing more and more of that workload come through. And now, you know, the conversation is shifting to 8K. And, you know, especially with our WX and the workstation professionals that are looking at not just broadcast quality digital creation, but movie industry quality digital creation, then that's where we'll see forcing a lot of updates. Because those, you know, if you go look at the credits on any recent Marvel movie, the amount of visual effects houses that were included in there is, you know, it's hundreds. It wasn't one studio that did it. It was 110 or more. I don't know the actual number. It's a massive amount. And they're all using, you know, workstations to do this processing. And it's a blend of CPU and GPU. And they need applications that can scale up and do these beautiful, high-quality renders. And that's where Threadripper is going to go.
Yeah, I think I was reading recently that the visual effects industry is a $250 billion industry now, which is just insane. I'm just going to bug you with a couple more questions, James, and I'm going to let you go because we're running a little longer. I have a question in the chat that I know you're not going to answer, but I'll speculate after you say you won't answer it. Joe's asking, what about 6 or 8 cores per CCX for a next-gen Zen 2? Is it possible AMD's going to increase core counts further with the future chip, or is 32 cores where it's going to be at for a while?
That's a great question. And if the SEC rules allow me to disclose information about our products without advising investors, I'd be happy to answer. But unfortunately, it's against the law and our company policy. So I can't answer. Sorry.
But I will speculate for you, Joe. I will speculate that because Zen 2 will be produced on a more advanced manufacturing process, and the dies will likely be smaller, and they'll likely be able to pack more cores onto a similar slice of silicon, there will probably be more cores per die. Whether or not the max core count changes is another story, but you'll likely see higher core counts per die, per CCX in the future. If I'm speculating, I know nothing. James didn't tell me anything. I'm totally guessing, but I would guess that that's happening. We also have a question about, let me just read it quickly, make sure it's not too bad here. Craig, I don't think he could comment on that either. It's a question on 7 nanometer and whether you're happy with what's coming out of the foundries. Any hints on 7 nanometer you can give, James? Or too early to say?
We're very excited about what the potential for 7 nanometer is. I wish we could say more, but, you know, again, it's those pesky investor relations law, the Security and Exchange Commission are very particular about disclosing information that materially affects a company that's publicly traded. So No bueno, man. Sorry, bud.
And you're not going to proclaim that you guys have secured funding to go private like a certain other company, right? We're not going to get any news like that on this podcast, right? No? Just kidding.
As soon as that comes in, man, we're ready.
Gotcha. So just finally, one more quick, simple softball, and I think I'm going to let you go unless there's anything that you want to get out here to the community. In the launch piece, I covered 2990WX and the 2950X, but as of today, it's just the 2990WX you can buy. The other chips are going to roll out later, correct?
Yeah, that's right. We've got the 2950X coming at the end of the month, August 31st. That will go on sale. That's our 16-core, 32-thread product. And then in October, we'll be back again with another WX, the 2970WX. That's 24 cores, 48 threads. And the 12-core which is an X series. So that's a 2920X, and that's 12 core, 24 thread. So pricing for all those has already been published. I'm sure Marco's got it in his article. So give that a read to find out what those price points are, see where you feel those are. We're having some fun with some summer promotions on the first gen Threadrippers right now. So right now, I think you've got an incredibly compelling reason to look at the Threadripper platform, even if it's the first gen, because you've got that incredible scalable platform. You'll be able to upgrade to the second gen later on in time, and we'll keep moving on with some fun new products in the future. Regarding cores, threads, nanometers, all that stuff, love to hear your feedback on where you think we should go. You know, so reach out to Marco, tell him what you want to see in a Ryzen product in next year or the year after that, whenever the next time you're ready to buy is. We want to hear it.
Cool, man. Sounds good. I had really, as an enthusiast, a longtime enthusiast, who even, you know, I was into, you know, two-piece setups back in the Celeron days. That's one of the things that's sort of lost on some people. Even if you don't run single apps that are hugely threaded, having all those core resources also helps if you are multitasker, you have a bunch of stuff going on in the background as well. So personally, as a longtime enthusiast, I am psyched to see what AMD did to the market with all these additional cores. If you remember, you know, a year and a half ago, the max core count on a desktop was very different. So the market has transformed, and in large part, it's due to the pressure that AMD has put on their competitors and what AMD has introduced. That's not anybody being a fanboy. That's fact. You know, the market has changed because of what AMD's done with Ryzen and what they did with Threadripper. So, James, I just want to thank you for coming on. We have Dave traveling out in Germany, checking out some new GPU stuff, and Chris is working hard in the lab, so it's just me available. So I got a fantastic guest, so we didn't have to cancel the podcast. I think it went well, James. Anything you want to say to the community? Any parting words?
Just thank you very much. Really appreciate you guys helping us with the Ryzen effect to redevelop and redefine what a consumer and desktop processor should be. And love to hear the feedback on where to go next.
Awesome. Thanks, James. So guys, I hope you liked what you saw today. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to Hot Hardware on YouTube and make sure you tick that reminder bell so you know when we have a new video going up or a new podcast coming. Lots of cool video reviews up on the site as well. It's not just 2.5 Geeks. And also come by hothardware.com. We only talk about a fraction of the news and articles that we post here on the podcast. There are dozens of articles every day covering everything from mobile devices to processors. And we're all over the place. We are on Facebook. We're on YouTube. We're on Google+. You name it, you can find Hot Hardware. So once again, Marco Cipetta for Hot Hardware. I want to really thank James Pryor from AMD. I thought this was a fun talk. Thanks for stopping by.